Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and at 13 hours GMT on Wednesday, the 12th of April, these are our main stories. President Biden calls for the return of power-sharing government in Northern Ireland. Russia says a video of a Ukrainian soldier being beheaded is awful, but insists its veracity should be checked. And the military government in Myanmar confirms its forces carried out an attack on a village on Tuesday in which many people died. Also, in this podcast, Elon Musk tells the BBC about his takeover of Twitter.
The pain level of Twitter has been extremely high. This hasn't been some sort of party.
President Biden has been in Northern Ireland, marking the 25th anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement, which was designed to bring an end to decades of political and religious violence. Shortly before we recorded this podcast, Mr. Biden gave a speech, but not at Stormont, the seat of devolved government and the Northern Ireland Assembly. That's because the Assembly hasn't been sitting for months in a continuing row over trading arrangements in and out of Northern Ireland in the wake of Britain leaving the European Union. Instead, he spoke at Ulster University in Belfast, and here's a flavour of what he had to say.
As a friend, I hope it's not too presumptuous for me to say that I believe democratic institutions established through the Good Friday Agreement remain critical to the future of Northern Ireland. It's a decision for you to make, not for me to make. But it seems to me they're related. An effective, devolved government that reflects the people of Northern Ireland and is accountable to them, a government that works to find ways through hard problems together, is going to draw even greater opportunity in this region. So I hope the Assembly and the Executive will soon be restored.
Before his speech, he did meet local political leaders as well as the British Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak. Our political correspondent, Rob Watson, is in Belfast.
We haven't had a proper readout yet, but I think it's fair to assume, Jackie, that they will have been discussing what is the best way of getting power sharing back up and running here in Northern Ireland. And I think it's probably pretty clear that both men have agreed that you can't bully the party that's currently refusing to join that. That's the Democratic Unionist Party, the main party that represents those sort of Protestants who would prefer there to be the Northern Ireland staying in the UK.
And what is it that they hope this visit to Belfast will achieve?
Modest in some ways, but really spectacular in other ways. And that is just to remind people just how extraordinary it is that there is now peace in this part of the world. I mean, yes, it is still an extremely divided society, divided along sectarian lines. Yes, the power sharing has broken down. But I think both the President and Rishi Sunak and others are just trying to get people, not just here in Northern Ireland, but around the world, to say, hey, come on, guys, we can beat ourselves up about what hasn't worked, but let's just remind ourselves of what an extraordinary achievement it was, given the level of violence, given the level of hatred, and how long it had gone on for.
Now, next on Mr. Biden's tour is the Republic of Ireland. He is very proud of his links to Ireland, isn't he?
He is indeed. And I should say, before we move on to Southern Ireland, to the Irish Republic, that is something that, you know, for some in the unionist community here in Northern Ireland, that makes them think of him less as an honest broker. But anyway, yes, hugely important. And I would describe his trip to the South as something as a mixture of sort of personal and politics. Personally, as you say, very proud of his Irish roots. He'll be going to visit places where his ancestors come from. But my goodness, definitely a bit of politics. I don't think it'll do him any harm with Irish American voters, all the millions of them, for them to see him here in Ireland, revisiting his roots.
That was Rob Watson in Belfast. Well, while President Biden is enjoying the plaudits in Ireland, his predecessor and possible opponent at the next election, Donald Trump, has been having a rather tougher time. He has already been indicted on fraudulent accounting charges, and there are plenty more legal problems coming down the line towards him. Mr. Trump has now given his first interview since that indictment. He told Tucker Carlson on Fox News that he was going to stay in the presidential race, and he talked more about what happened on that day in New York when he was processed and appeared in court. Justin Webb heard all about it from our North America correspondent, David Willis.
Perhaps the most astonishing revelation, I think, Justin, was Donald Trump's assertion that as he was being indicted, court officials in Lower Manhattan last week, among them hardened police officers and prison guards, were crying. The former president said that many of the staff at the facility were in tears or close to it, to use his words, and he said they apologised to him as they were processing him. Once again, he said he'd done nothing wrong and asked if he would drop out, potentially, of the 2024 presidential race if he's convicted of a crime. He said that he wouldn't. And it's worth noting that as well as the 34 counts of falsifying business records that he's facing in Manhattan, Mr. Trump is also the subject of separate criminal investigations in the state of Georgia and here in Washington, D.C.
And yet, within the Republican Party, there doesn't seem to be any way of stopping him certainly running, but also potentially winning the nomination.
There isn't. He remains even more popular, and that's a point that he made in the course of this interview, that he's actually up in the polls as a result of the current court imbroglio that he finds himself in. He spent the remainder of this interview touting his suitability for office once again and the close relationships that he developed with certain world leaders during his previous time in the Oval Office. Not, I might add, the sort of people you'd expect to find on a top 10 list of the world's greatest democratic leaders. He complimented the presidents of Russia, China and North Korea on their intellect, and he called Saudi Arabia's leaders great people. Mm.
And you point towards something there that is a problem for the Republican Party, isn't it? Which is that he is looking confident in the Republican primary, but there's still no obvious way that he wins the general election, the presidential election. In other words, he doesn't seem to be building support outside his base. Is that fair to say?
I think that is fair to say. And, of course, there is another consideration in all this, and it is the governor of the state of Florida, Ron DeSantis, who has been touting a book and has been putting on a lot of support for his potential run for the presidency. He's yet to declare that he's running, but he will be a very popular choice if these legal woes do end up grinding Donald Trump down.
That was David Willis. Now, I should warn you that our next story is disturbing. A video has been circulating overnight, purportedly showing the beheading of a Ukrainian soldier by Russians. The president of Ukraine, Volodymyr Zelensky, called Russia's army beasts, saying the video showed the world what inhuman actions the Russian army was prepared to carry out.
This is something that no one in the world can ignore. How easily these beasts kill. This video of the execution of a Ukrainian prisoner of war, the world must see it. This is a video of Russia as it really is. What kind of creatures they are. There are no people for them. A son, a brother, a husband, someone's child. This is a video of Russia trying to make just that, the new norm, such a habit of destroying life.
The Kremlin has responded, saying the video was awful, but added that its authenticity needs to be checked. BBC Monitoring's Russia editor Vitaly Shevchenko is following the story and the Russian response.
The spokesman for Vladimir Putin, Dmitry Peskov, he was asked about this video at his daily press briefing, and he called this footage horrific. But at the same time, he appeared to question its authenticity, and he said that it needs to be checked.
And when something like this comes out, how difficult is it to verify it? What do you do?
Well, you would look at the quality of the video, at what it shows, and the behaviour of the people appearing in it. And to be honest, it's really difficult to fake something like this, something like a beheading video. And also, it's not the only one. Unfortunately, there appears to be a pattern. There's also a video apparently showing two beheaded Ukrainian soldiers that's been circulating online. There's a picture of a head impaled in a spike. And all this comes slightly more than a month after a Ukrainian soldier was apparently filmed being executed by his Russian captors. So all this shows how horrible, how brutal this war is.
Vitaly Shevchenko. A report by energy experts says we will use less fossil fuels to generate electricity this year, and therefore less greenhouse gas will be released, a major step in helping the world avoid dangerous levels of climate change. The study by the analysts Ember says a boom in renewable energy sources means that 2023 is likely to see the first ever annual drop in the use of coal, oil and gas to produce energy, outside of years of global recession or pandemic. Our environment correspondent Matt McGraw has more details.
Thanks to the growth of renewable energy, the electricity produced around the world last year was in effect the cleanest ever made. Enough solar power was installed to meet the needs of a country like South Africa. But even so, the rise in demand for electricity outpaced the growth of green sources, with the use of coal also edging up. That's expected to change this year, with the rise in renewable energy sources set to slightly reduce demand for fossil fuels. Some experts say that 2023 will be a turning point. Key to this energy transition will be China. The biggest user of coal for electricity also installed around half the world's new wind turbines last year and around 40% of solar. If coal use peaks in China before 2025, researchers believe the chances of keeping global temperatures in check will increase significantly.
That was Matt McGraw. A BBC investigation has discovered that 40% of current English Premier League football clubs have been sponsored by financial firms that have subsequently been banned by the British Financial Conduct Authority, been fined, or are under investigation. Most of the companies were offering complex financial tools to ordinary people. But as the World Service Investigation Unit discovered, many were not playing by the rules. Jo Inwood has this report.
We like it. You can hear the roar of the crowds of Elland Road, the home of Leeds United, one of the most famous names in English football, and today they're playing Crystal Palace.
Come on, Lee.
Three years ago, 2020, this exact fixture, as the winning goal went in, a name flashed up on the billboards, millions of people would have seen it. It was FXVC.
At that time, I trusted them to be a professional company.
It was an endorsement that gave people like Phil and Joyce the confidence to hand over tens of thousands of pounds.
The fact that they sponsored Leeds Football Club, I just took them as being a proper investment platform where, yes, we would put our money in. Yes, there was a risk. In my mind, a calculated risk.
One of the main things he was saying, Phil, you do realise you're going to be a millionaire.
I did. He said, I will make
and
a
this will happen fast.
He did.
On those promises, Phil and Joyce eventually handed over £200,000 to FXVC. The company were what's known as a CFD, or Contract for Difference firm, providing a platform for speculating on the price of things like gold and Bitcoin. The problem was that FXVC was running a scam, using pressure tactics and false promises to get clients to make trades they were always likely to lose. Phil and Joyce were soon told their money was frozen and they needed to put in more to unlock it.
So I was just watching it go down, down, down. We had lost £341,000 within 7 days.
So FXVC, as far as I'm concerned, were just a platform to con people into investment. So there was no real investment there. They don't care who they hurt. They don't care who they take money off. They don't care if you're an old age pensioner. They don't care if you're 100 years old. They just want to take your money off you.
Within weeks, FXVC had been banned by the British Financial Conduct Authority. But the money was gone. And this is just one example of a wider problem. A BBC investigation has found that 40% of Premier League clubs have taken sponsorship money from firms like this, that have subsequently been banned, fined, or are being investigated.
They have to be stopped. They have to be stopped. Organisations.
Clark Carlisle is a former Premier League footballer and chair of the Footballers' Union. He now campaigns on issues around mental health, following his own well-publicised troubles.
You know, there's an unavoidable link between a supporter and their club and the companies that are affiliated with them. So for organisations to take advantage of that with mistruths, they have to be stopped.
What action needs to be taken? What needs to change?
I believe that there needs to be greater scrutiny over the way that football clubs are funded and the organisations that they align themselves with. But this scrutiny has to come from without, so that we know that there is no vested interest in making the decisions about what's suitable for our game.
Come on, Lee! Come on, Lee!
In a statement, FXVC denied any wrongdoing.
Come on, Lee! Come on, Lee!
Now, in fairness to Leeds United, when they had a relationship with FXVC, they were a regulated company, but in Cyprus. And Leeds told us that as soon as they were banned by the FCA, they cut all ties, which is basically the same thing that all the Premier League clubs said. The truth is, this is bigger than Leeds United. It's bigger even than football. It's about dodgy companies ripping off customers for millions, maybe even billions of pounds, and using the beautiful game to legitimise an ugly industry.
Joe Winwood and his full investigation, The Billion-Dollar Scam, can be found on BBC iPlayer or on BBC News this weekend. Still to come, the volcano that's thrown a plume of ash 20 kilometres into the sky. We'll be right back after this.
The Comb is the podcast from the BBC World Service that seeks out stories and voices from across Africa that might otherwise go unheard.
It was a moment that was filled with hope.
It was emotional.
I had to sit down and put myself in other people's shoes.
Catch up with the whole series now by searching for The Comb.
This is The Comb.
The Comb.
The Comb.
Wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
The Comb.
Elon Musk has given a long and varied interview to the BBC on topics ranging from what he called the pain of buying Twitter to the way he's changed its verification system. In an unplanned, off-the-cuff event, live-streamed on Twitter, he sat down with our technology correspondent James Clayton to discuss his first 6 months at the social media company. James asked him if he had any regrets about buying Twitter.
The pain level of Twitter has been extremely high. This hasn't been some sort of party. So it's been really quite a stressful situation, you know, for the last several months. Not an easy one. But apart from the pain, I mean, so it's been quite painful, but I think at the end of the day, it should have been done. I think, were there many mistakes made along the way? Of course. All's well that ends well. And so I feel like we're headed to a good place. You know, we're roughly break even. I think we're trending towards being cash flow positive very soon, like literally in a matter of months. The advertisers are returning. I think the quality of recommended tweets has improved significantly, and we've taken a lot of feedback from people that have looked at the open source recommendation algorithm, and we've made a lot of improvements even since that was made open source, and we're going to keep doing that.
I think in February you said the last 3 months have been extremely tough. I wouldn't wish that pain on anyone. Can you talk me through the emotional strain of this?
Yeah, I mean, look, I've been under constant attack. It's not like I, you know, have a stone cold heart or something like that. You know, if you're under constant criticism and attack, and then that gets fed to you nonstop, including through Twitter, that it's rough. So I think it is actually important to get negative feedback. I don't turn replies off. And I actually removed my entire block list, so I don't block anyone either. So somebody can, you know, so I get like a lot of negative feedback.
Elon Musk went on to say he'd found a lot of the stories about him in the media hurtful. James Clayton also asked him about the changes to Twitter's blue tick verification system.
I must confess to some delight in removing the verified badge from the New York Times. That was great. Anyway, they're still alive and well. They're doing fine.
But on a serious note, it could flame disinformation again if you have verified accounts that are from anyone who can pay money. They go up to potentially the top of feeds. They get more action on Twitter. And traditional media that may not pay for verification doesn't. Do you see how that could potentially be a driver of misinformation?
Well, I mean, I think the media is a driver of misinformation much more than the media would like to admit that they are.
That's a different question.
Yeah, but you are sort of saying like who knows best, the average citizen or you know someone who is a journalist? I think in a lot of cases it is the average citizen that knows more than the journalist. In fact, I mean, very often when I see an article about some something that I know a lot about, and I read the article, and it's like that they get a lot wrong. Sort of the best interpretation is there is someone who doesn't really understand what's going on in industry, has only a few facts to play with, has to come up with an article. Now, it's going to be, you know, it's not going to hit the bullseye. So if somebody is actually in the fray, or like an expert in the field, and was actually there, and writes about their experience of being actually there, I think that actually that's in a lot of cases going to be better than a journalist, because the journalist wasn't there.
Elon Musk. Taiwan's governing party has announced its candidate for the next presidential election, a man who has promised to strengthen the island against threats from China. Michael Bristow has the details.
As expected, Taiwan's Democratic Progressive Party has chosen the current vice president, William Lai, to stand next January. The president, Tsai Ing-wen, cannot run again because she'll have completed two terms. In the past, Mr. Lai has made strong statements in support of Taiwan's independence. If he wins, the island's relationship with China, which considers the island its own territory, will probably continue to be strained. Who leads Democratic Taiwan is important because it's become a point of tension between China and the United States, Taipei's most important ally.
Michael Bristow. Now, yesterday we carried early reports of an attack by military aircraft on a village in Myanmar, killing a large number of civilians in the central Sagaing region. Today, the Myanmar military government confirmed that its aircraft carried out the attack. Survivors say they've collected at least 80 bodies so far. The Deputy Director of Human Rights Watch Asia Division, Phil Robertson, was one of those condemning the attack.
This is part of a larger pattern that we are seeing across Myanmar, where the security forces are targeting civilians in a systematic way. These are the sort of crimes against humanity that we have been speaking about, and it calls out for an urgent international investigation to get to the bottom of what has happened here and other atrocities that have been committed over the past several months.
Our Southeast Asia correspondent is Jonathan Head.
It was pretty sustained and incredibly destructive, mostly because there was a very large crowd there. I mean, the military government has responded by claiming it was attacking a ceremony being held by a PDF. These are the People's Defence Forces, which you see all over Myanmar now, which have taken up the armed struggle against the military. And the view of the military government is they're a legitimate target. Some military websites are even claiming only PDF armed volunteers were there. That's clearly untrue, looking at the pictures of the victims that we've seen. There were obviously a lot of women and children there too. And because it was so crowded, and because this was a big ceremony in this village that brought in a lot of people from surrounding villages, we think at least six villages were affected and lost people. The carnage was dreadful because they were using a very large bomb, which hit a meeting hall. It was a direct hit. It looks like a precision strike by possibly a guided bomb. And then 20 minutes of strafing by a Russian helicopter gunship. These are incredibly destructive aircraft, and they do cause awful casualties if you have an awful lot of people together, which was what was happening yesterday.
And have you or your colleagues been able to speak to survivors? What are survivors saying?
They said, you know, we're used to seeing aircraft. This entire area has been resisting military rule. They say sometimes on the other side of the Irrawaddy River, that's the biggest one going through Myanmar, which is near them, the soldiers on the other side fire the odd shell over there, but they'd never been attacked from the air and they didn't expect it, and it came out of the blue. And they were also rather shocked that when they were picking up the bodies, the aircraft came back in the afternoon and strafed them again. There's nothing accidental about this. I think this is quite clearly a targeted strike that is meant to send a message. And it's not the first time the military government has done this. They bombed a concert in Kachin State in October last year, which caused huge casualties among civilians as well, because it was a symbol of resistance. The Kachin army has been resisting the military for a long time. This village that was targeted yesterday, by opening this office, was making it clear it is loyal to the ousted government, not to the military government, and it looks like they've paid a heavy price for that.
Jonathan Head. The Shivyeluch volcano in the Kamchatka Peninsula in Russia's Far East has sent an enormous cloud of ash 20 kilometres high into the sky. It covers an area of 108,000 square kilometres, coating nearby villages in drifts of ash. Vera Mayerova is one of the residents of Kliuchi village who've been affected.
The roads are completely terrible. It's very difficult to take the kids to kindergarten. Pupils at schools are studying from home because it's impossible to walk outside because of the ashfall.
The eruption began on Tuesday and was reported to be continuing earlier today, although less fiercely. Mike Burton, Professor of Volcanology at the University of Manchester, has been talking about it to my colleague, Victoria Owen-Kunder.
This is a significant eruption for Kamchatka. And Shivaluch last had its biggest eruption was in 2015, but that was smaller than this. And this is probably the largest explosion we've seen from this volcano since we've had modern observational capacities to see the cloud being produced.
And what kind of disruption or damages can these eruptions, like what we've seen with the Shivaluch volcano, cause?
There are two main impacts, local and more regional or even global. There's been some dramatic footage shown of the ash deposit produced by the eruption. And that immediately produced a nearly 10 centimetre thick distribution of ash over a very wide area. And that's incredibly disruptive and dangerous just for people simply slipping and traffic, not being able to see where it's going. But also there's some health implications for breathing in the ash. That's a really significant local impact for the local population. But then more regionally, there's the potential impact of the volcanic ash on air traffic. And you'll remember in 2010, there was the big eruption in Iceland, which disrupted transatlantic air traffic. This eruption is quite close to one of the main channels that goes from Asia to the west coast of the US. And therefore, people are watching it very carefully. And the reason that it's really important is because if an airplane, if a jet engine flies through the ash can melt because it gets very hot inside these engines. And then the melted ash can accumulate in a cooler part of the engine. And that basically freezes and then blocks the engine. And this occurred to dramatic impact in 1982 when a British Airways flight from Indonesia hit a big ash cloud. All the engines failed and they had a very fantastic pilot who was able to recover the plane, and so no harm was done. But It's a very expensive and very dangerous event if there's a big interaction.
That was Mike Burton of Manchester University. Now let's end this edition of the Global News Pod by returning to our top story, President Biden's visit to Northern Ireland. The trip, of course, coinciding with the 25th anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement. Children born since then have had a very different life from the one their parents and grandparents experienced. And one of them is the BBC's Jordan Kenny.
I was born in 1998, the year the Good Friday Agreement was signed here in Northern Ireland. It means I grew up after the Troubles ended and didn't have to worry as much as maybe my parents did, for example, about getting caught up in the conflict that was happening here. Me and others like me who were born after it was signed are known as peace babies. And I'm keen to find out where they think Northern Ireland could be in the next 25 years.
We're very ignorant to the pain and the suffering that our parents or grandparents went through. As a generation, we will never understand that.
When I say the term, the Troubles, what do you think of straight away?
Even just like the army getting aboard the bus and them acting like it's just a normal thing.
Mm.
Like, we never worry about violence. You know, we don't get on a school bus and fear for our lives like people did. I think we're very separate from it, and it feels like ages ago for us.
Is that something that you think still exists, that you would feel afraid to say whether you're a Catholic or a Protestant in certain areas, Caris?
Yeah, I've heard of, like, friends of mine have been certain places and they've said that they are maybe Catholic when they're Protestant or Protestant when they're Catholic, because they were, like, they felt that they would be under threat if they said that they were a Protestant or a Catholic, just because the people and the environment they were in.
I think that it's all about appreciating someone else that's different from you and knowing that their ideas and their ideals may be different than you, but that doesn't mean you can't be friends with them, that doesn't mean you can't work beside them, that doesn't mean you can't train beside them, because the reality of Northern Ireland is everywhere you go, you're going to be with someone who's a different religion than you, who has different ideas from you, and that's what you have to accept and move on from.
Moments after the Good Friday Agreement was signed in 1998, Kerry was born. She's now 25, but she's grown up in the shadow of it her whole life, and she has a bit of a personal connection to it as well. Kerry, what are we going through here?
Yeah, so these are all from 1998, where my parents did some interviews for the newspapers.
So this one is the Sunday World.
the headline is My Hope, and it's a picture of you.
Yeah.
And the first sentence of the article is, this is our hope for the future, literally.
Yeah, so my middle name is Hope, Kerry Hope Sarah Patterson. My parents named me this, I guess, as for them it meant hope for the future generations of Northern Ireland.
And that hope that they had, do you think what they were hoping for has happened?
I think for the most part it has. You know, the violence has ended for the most part and the communities are a lot more integrated than they were. You know, I think they would still like to see more progress in terms of the government and getting Stormont back up and running, but they're really proud of how I've been able to have such a happy and healthy childhood and that's been echoed throughout Northern Ireland for my generation.
That report by our very own peace baby, Jordan Kenny. And that's it from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you would like to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, do please send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Annie Smith. The producer was Peter Hyatt. Our editor is Karen Martin. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, goodbye.